This is the Comics Alternative Interviews, a conversation with Mark Foger. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative Interviews. I'm Derek, and on this episode, I have the pleasure of talking with Mark Foger. His new book, Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture, comes out this week from Tomorrow's Publishing. But before we get to that conversation, I want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative Interviews is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, DCBService.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you can find that those discounts are going to be anywhere from 20 to 35% off the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials will be at 45% off the cover price, sometimes 50% off of the cover, but every now and again you can find discounts that go higher than that. And one of the things that we really enjoy on the Comics Alternative is DCB Services bundles. And this month they have bundles from Valiant, Marvel, and a whole slew from DC. So for instance, you can get new miniseries bundle from DC, as well as DC Kids bundle, the DC New Age of Heroes bundle, and they actually have several Rebirth bundles, and you can get those for 50% off of the cover price. It's always better when you bundle at Discount Comic Book Service. Their website is DCBService.com. You gotta go there for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your titles there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you. I had a really nice time talking with Mark Foger. He has a new book coming out this week called Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture. And it concerns, I guess, what you could call groovy culture from the mid-1960s into the early 1970s. But as you'll hear in our conversation, one of the things that Mark does is try to go back and look at the earlier roots of what eventually became this kind of groovy mindset in pop culture. We talk about a number of comics from this period, but we go beyond that to talk about a variety of media, such as music, television, film, fashion, and art. And what Mark does in Groovy is to go over the broader landscape of groovy culture during that time. So it was a fun conversation. Let's go ahead and listen to it now. I am talking with Mark Foger. His new book, Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture, comes out from Tomorrow's Publishing tomorrow, in fact, November 15th. Mark, welcome to the Comics Alternative.
Derek, thank you for having me. I'm psyched.
Well, I think psych is a useful word in light of the topic of your book, Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture. And as a way of, let's say, getting the ball rolling here, in a nutshell, what is Groovy?
Well, first of all, thanks for your interest and thanks for having me on, Derek. Groovy is chiefly a book about how groovy culture, psychedelia, and crazy music and dances and fashions affected the culture. How there was a back and forth between the politics of the time and the art that was being created, and sort of where it came from. There's a timeline at the beginning that has quick little bits of the term groovy was coined by jazz music. musicians in the 20s. We stole so much from those guys. And, LSD was developed in the 30s, and the kaleidoscope was developed in the 19th century. So all the little precedents, all the little harbingers, but it really came together first for music is my theory. I thought that first when groups like the Beatles and the Stones first started experimenting with hallucinogens, and then it started to affect their music, and then it started to affect their fashions, like the things that our heroes, the Beatles and the Stones, would wear. And then kids in suburban America would see what the Beatles were wearing, whether or not they partook in hallucinogens, and start kind of imitating their heroes. And the music got trippier and trippier, or groovier, and then it started affecting like so many other things, because as marketeers, if they sense a dollar can be made, so there were groovy TV shows, groovy movies, art, of course, the posters from San Francisco, and even comic books, and I know we'll be talking about that. Mm-hmm. But it just went on and on. It kind of hit its crescendo in the early 70s, but you still see it around here and there.
You know, you mentioned the effect that the groovy culture, broadly speaking, had on suburban culture. One of the things that I appreciate about your book is, I mean, definitely that timeline. I think that was very useful that you started off by including that timeline. But then right before that, your introduction. I mean, you explain in this intro your own experiences with groovy culture. And, I mean, you grew up in the suburbs in New Jersey, and you write about, I guess, a brush with fame where you go to, what is it, Echelon Mall to meet Tiny Tim?
Yes, well, it was the Morristown Mall meet Tiny Tim, which is, one South Jersey mall is just like another. They were interchangeable in those days. But I can tell you the exact date. That was June 7th, 1969, when I was 11. And the reason I know the date is because Tiny Tim autographed my copy of his book that he was hawking at the time. And he was nice enough to put the date down, so I have that fixed, But, I was 11. I was a kid. I liked Tiny Tim from Laughing. He made me laugh. I liked his stance as a totally unique human being. And my mom pulled up in front of the mall just as his town car was pulling up. So he was getting out of his car, and I just ran after him. And he looked like he was about 7 feet tall. And this was like prime Tiny, 1969. So he had, the very pale complexion and the long straggly hair. He had a cape on, even though it was the summertime. And, I got his autograph, and I drew a little picture of him. And Derek, one funny thing is that, I actually, in my first draft up for the groovy cover, I had Tiny Tim as my central image. I thought this will make people go, what? And it'll be intriguing. And then, almost everybody who looked at it said, like, no, 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 this isn't going to sell books. So I was rescued from that thought.
And you devote quite a bit of time to Tiny Tim in the television section of the book. I think this comes right after your comments and memorabilia on Laugh-In, because Tiny Tim, basically was debuted to America through Laugh-In. And then you write about him and include some Tiny Tim memorabilia. And I really appreciate that. And not only when it comes to Tiny Tim, but the way that the book is structured. This is, I think, what a lot of readers find in tomorrow texts like this, in that they're really neatly organized and beautifully designed. Not only in terms of how the text is laid out, but how it's interspersed with images. Sometimes pages are, if not image only, then definitely image heavy, and there's quite a bit of that in Groovy.
Well, thank you, Derek, from your lips to God's ears. But I designed the book as well. Yeah, I designed the book as well.
Superstar,
So So that's exactly what I was going for. And the way to structure something like that is a challenge, because you want the thing to kind of be, since you're covering an era, you want it to kind of be chronological, but it doesn't always, there's no one size fits all approach. It doesn't always go like cleanly chronological. So you do themes, and then sometimes you double back on, you know, like I have a TV section in the middle, but then at the end I go for the kind of post psychedelia, you know, Brady Bunch, Partridge Family, Saturday Morning, Puffin Stuff kind of stuff. So that is the challenge and the fun of it too. It's like a puzzle putting something like that together. You want it to be inviting, but it also has to be a reading experience. So I've done that all my career. I've been, you know, in newspapers all my career doing that kind of work. So this is just fun. You know, it's like I said, it's a fun puzzle.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the thematic approach. So you cover, as we've mentioned, music, but you even break that up. You make a differentiation between top 40 or singles musical acts and then album bands. There's a section on, you know, a couple on television, the one that you mentioned that's about in the middle of the book, and then the kind of post groovy family fair stuff of the Partridge Family, Saturday Morning Cartoons, a section on film, a section on art, where you know, and we can talk about this, right? Quite a bit about comics from this era, the Summer of Love, festivals, a particular section that I find interesting on Messiah, since Jesus Christ Superstar was such a central part of this era. And it really is approachable. It gives a good overview of this, I don't know if you want to call it a movement or a tendency, but maybe a more appropriate word would be one that you use, flowering of this sensibility in the late 60s into the early 1970s.
Well, thank you, Derek. And I really do think it was a flowering. Like where I first used that term is when we were talking earlier about the Beatles. You know, when the Beatles first came to America, they were like mop tops. You know, they were just they were doing pop. All their songs were about, you know, kind of, you know, top 40 topics like I Want to Hold Your Hand, and then they got more serious, and then their sound flowered. You know, literally and figuratively. Well, I guess not literally, but yeah, and then. Yeah, the misused word, you know. You mentioned the distinction between the top 40 and the album bands. That's something that, you know, a lot of people think actually happened during that decade. Like Tommy James of the Shondells says that in the year 1968, in the space of 6 months, this is his point of view, the music market suddenly turned from the singles market, which it had always been, or it had been for years, and then suddenly it became an album market. So it became more important to put out an album that was a cohesive listening experience, didn't have any clunkers on it, and that's the way you thought of things. You didn't think of them as singles, and it was not coincidentally. You know, people's radio listening habits also changed. They went from, you know, this was the rise of FM radio and FM stereo radio. So they were playing deep cuts. They didn't have playlists. So people of that age, you know, like teenagers in early 20s were moving over from listening to AM pop to, you know, rock on FM radio. And, you know, so it was, but I love the top 40, you know, and I think that that's where in top 40 is where, groovy culture really became pervasive, because you could be in a bowling alley and you could hear, Incense and Peppermint by the Strawberry Alarm Clock playing through the loudspeaker because it happened to be on an AM station, you know, or Hurdy Gurdy Man by Donovan, and you knew it was weird. You knew it wasn't like, you know, the Dovells, you know. So I think AM radio and top 40 was like very instrumental in the mainstreaming of groovy culture.
Yeah, Yeah. Interesting also in making this distinction, as you do between, let's say, the top 40 and the album emphasis, is your comments on the Zombies, that they would have been one of these singles or top 40 acts if it weren't for Odyssey and Oracle.
Odyssey and Oracle, it is a masterpiece. And I think anybody who was prone to appreciate an album like Sgt. Pepper or an album like Pet Sounds, I think that they just have to listen to that Zombies album once and they realize, oh, that's the third great psychedelic album. You know, it really is. Those guys, and it's funny because not only was it their last album, didn't even come out until after they were broken up. They did that last album. They went for it. They did it at Abbey Road in the studios in England. They used the same equipment the Beatles used on Sgt. Pepper. They had one or two of the same engineers, and there's even some sound effects, some keyboard sound effects that I know of one, but I can't, you know, think of the song title, that is one that was used on Sgt. Pepper, and you know it when you hear it. So it's really an epic, you know. And then they broke up, and then the big surprise, Derek, was that Time of the Season, which would not have been their pick for the single, but it was one of those DJs found it and played it, and there was response, and the record company put it out. But that was a monster hit in 1969. It was on the radio all the time. It's still on the radio all the time, and they were already broken up. There was no band to tour behind Time of the Season by the Zombies.
Well, you know, I do think it's appropriate that you start the book by entering through the music of the era. You know, as you said a moment ago, where things really got started with groovy culture is with the music, the Beatles, the Stones. But you also pay quite a bit of attention to one of my favorites, and that is the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, and specifically Brian Wilson. And in your interview with him that you include here, you know, he says that he regrets dropping acid, and I can understand that given what his life has been like, you know, since the 1960s. But it's hard to imagine something like Pet Sounds or that wonderful failed experiment Smile having been what they actually are without him doing that drug experimentation.
Yeah, that's the age-old question, you know. And a lot of times when I talk to rockers of a certain age, you know, I'll ask them, "Were you high when you recorded that song?" You know, and John Anderson of Yes once told me, "Sometimes," and he said, "Steve Howe was the master joint roller," you know. So I know that about Steve Howe, the Yes guitarist. But and Brian Wilson, it is true, Brian. I mean, he is a genius, certainly one of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century. He gives that honor to Burt Bacharach, by the way. But it's not just the songs, and it's not just the emotions or just the performances, but a huge part of it is the arrangements, especially on Pet Sounds, you know. But and then what preceded Pet Sounds was California Girls, and what followed it was Good Vibration. So I always think those were like bookends to this, you know, this great listening experience. And the funny thing was, his Pet Sounds was his response to the Beatles' Rubber Soul. He says he got high with some friends and he heard Rubber Soul, and he somehow felt competitive toward the Beatles and felt that he needed to answer them. And so that's how we got Pet Sounds.
You know, I referenced your interview with Brian Wilson, but we should also focus on the fact that you do many, many interviews throughout Groovy. And I was noticing you always contextualize it, like how and when you were talking to these various individuals. And many of these interviews are from a number of years ago. So I'm wondering, is this a book that was a long time in coming? And then you did these various interviews over the years, or had you been doing these interviews and then at one point you realized, you know, I ought to pull all of this together in a book about groovy culture?
Well, yeah, a little of both. I spent my whole career as most of my career as an entertainment reporter, and I did become an interview hound. And I was interested in talking to anybody who created the art that I responded to as a child. That would be a flip out to me to, you know, be able to talk to Kurtz Flan, who drew Superman, you know, my favorite mm-hmm. Superman artist, or, you know, whoever, somebody in television, somebody in movies. So there are 100 interview subjects, more than 100, I think, in Groovy, but, and then much more background that went into that. But as far as thinking it's time to do it, I have ideas for like 5 or 6 books that I already have most of the interviews done for, you know, but will I get to do them? I don't know. I need a publisher, you know, mm-hmm. but Monster Mash did well. So tomorrow's greenlit Groovy, which is a little out of their wheelhouse. And, you know, we got our fingers crossed this one will do well also. And I thought it was important for the reader to know what years an interview was done. Some of the interview subjects are deceased. Mm-hmm. But it's always good to know if they said it in, like in 2015, or if they said it in 1999. I think it provides important context.
Right. Sticking on the topic of music, I mean, not only do you talk about the greats like the Beatles, Brian Wilson, Rolling Stones, Cream, the Doors, but you also spend actually quite a bit of page space, more than you probably do with the Beatles and the Stones, total at least, on the Monkees. And, you know, I'm one of those who grew up, I guess, when the Monkees television show went into syndication. I was too young to see it, or at least to appreciate it, when it was originally aired in primetime. But I remember as a kid growing up, and I guess it was Saturday morning watching it when it went into syndication. And so I grew up loving the Monkees, both the music and the television show. And you definitely give a lot of time to the Monkees, not only in the television section, but also in the film section. I am so glad that there is a write-up on Head, which I absolutely love. In fact, I have taught that film a number of times in a narrative theory course that I used to teach, because it just completely explodes any notion of coherent plot.
Yeah, Davy Jones dancing with Tony Basil in black and white. Yeah, it's a crazy movie and very psychedelic. I mean, mm-hmm. it's crazily psychedelic. And because to me the Monkees were that was when people, producers were now trying to cash in on this thing, that the ball that was began rolling when the Beatles, you know, became popular. So they made these kind of faux Beatles, but wound up being quite a drama, in the sense that, they actually started asking for autonomy, and they actually started, you know, playing their own instruments and recording their own albums. So this fictional band became a real band. It's the weirdest thing. But it was only 2 seasons, and it was just so funny. And it's funny that you saw it on Saturday mornings, because, it ran 2 seasons beginning in 1966. And I don't think much time went by. It was like maybe a year or two later that they started running it on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. And that was quite subversive, because it was not a kiddie show when it was in prime time, although kids loved it, but it has little winks, has little adult things. It has Frank Zappa beating a 40s jalopy with a chain, you know, but it has there was even a very subtle anti-war reference once in a Christmas episode, if I'm not mistaken. But and then to show it on Saturday morning, I think is so subversive. And another weird thing about that period was that it seemed that almost every even cartoon show that was running on Saturday mornings around that time. So I'm thinking of shows like, Banana Splits was live action more or less, but, the Archie show and Josie and the Pussycats. And it seemed that all these groups were in bands, you know? So if you were like that correct age of, you were, you know, 8 years old in 1970, and you were seeing the Monkees and the Archies and, you know, and Josie and the Pussycats and even on Scooby-Doo, that group they weren't a band, but they always had a music video in that first season where they'd be running around from a ghost, and then there'd be a rock song in the background, and or the Banana Splits, and you'd probably be thinking like, oh, okay, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I'm going to be in a band and do all this crazy stuff.
The Monkees, brought to you by Kellogg's.
You know, I'm curious because in the last part of your book, in the section Family Fair, that's where you visit a lot of these shows that you just referenced, right? Like the Partridge Family, H.R. Puff and stuff, the Banana Splits, you know, the various Archie cartoons, you know, Sabrina as well. And I'm wondering, do you notice a difference in the, I guess, co-opting and the commodification of groovy culture from earlier in the 60s, like around the time of the Monkees television show, into the very late 60s, early 70s, where we have this, as you call it, family fair of Saturday morning series like Banana Splits or the Partridge Family, Brady Bunch?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was totally co-opted, by the mainstream or by the establishment, you know. I think that in real life, you know, the Brady Bunch went on in 69, Partridge Family went on in 70. In real life, the movement was waning. It wasn't a sustainable lifestyle. You know, in real life, there were things happening that were, you know, kind of terrible that spelled that the peak was over. You know, Woodstock was wonderful. Altamont was horrible. Mm-hmm. We had, four icons of 60s rock die at the same age, 27, within a 2-year period to the day. And that, of course, is, Brian Jones, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and, Jim Morrison. And they're eerily all the same age and to the day. And then, even a horrible, thing like the Manson murders was such bad PR for like for long hairs or for the commune concept. And also, as I say, it really wasn't sustainable. People, and I remember seeing this happen. People, were cutting their hair and putting on, quote unquote, straight clothes and entering the workforce. It had to be, you know. I think, David Crosby's song Almost Cut My Hair was a response, you know, in part to that, you know, although he never had to cut his hair because he never worked in an office. He was spared that indignity. But yeah, it was so after the golden age of the era, after the era had peaked, that's when, you know, they were putting out these programs like the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family, which borrowed from it, you know. They weren't, you know, all out psychedelic shows, but they definitely borrowed from it, and the Saturday morning cartoons definitely did. They were very psychedelic, a lot of those shows. You know, H.R. Puff and stuff is like an acid trip for children.
Oh, definitely. But you know, the interesting thing there is, you know, you, in your introduction, as I mentioned, you kind of situate yourself in this cultural phenomena, and I think very effectively, right? By talking about meeting Tiny Tim and how old you were at that time. I'm a little younger, so I came after the heyday, or I became aware of television, film, music, all of that stuff in terms of appreciating it after the heyday of this. But I definitely remember late 60s, certainly early 70s, watching shows like The Partridge Family, definitely The Banana Splits and H.R. Puff and stuff. And as a kid, I never thought of it as strange, surreal, psychedelic. I probably heard words like psychedelic and hippie, but it's not as if I linked them to the things that I was watching on television. And it was only later that it occurred to me, wow, this is a result of a lot of the cultural stuff that was churning at the time. And another thing that kind of brought this home to me is last year, when I was teaching at University of Texas at Dallas, in one of my classes that had multimedia capability, so I could bring up the internet, you know, at the snap of a finger, somehow, some reason, the Banana Splits came up in our conversation. And I must have brought it up because no one in my class knew it. Maybe one or two heard references to it. But when I mentioned the Banana Splits, the class had a blank look on their face as a whole. And so I said, you guys don't know the Banana Splits. So I pulled up YouTube and I showed them an opening of one of the Banana Split shows. And then after it was over with, they commented, God, does this explain your generation? Because they were they were really freaked out about it. And even though they didn't use the word, I don't think, psychedelic, they definitely described it in ways that were quite freaky. And I never thought of it that way. But, you know, someone of, let's say, college age or high school age, going on YouTube and looking at episodes of the Banana Splits, definitely H.R. Puff and stuff, and then maybe later shows like Lidsville, you know, those kind of live action shows, would look at that and just scratch their head. It's like, what is wrong with our parents? Does this explain how they are?
Yeah, that's very funny. You know, Sid and Marty Croft, of course, were the guys who created all those live action shows, Lidvilles and the Bugaloos and Sigmund and the Sea Monster, and they were on a roll. They're in Groovy, it is bizarre because we had no parental supervision on Saturday mornings because, you know, most of our parents were sleeping it off, you know, and we were eating, we were drinking Tang and eating, Quisp and Quake Pop-Tarts, you know, so we were sugared up. We really were in an altered state of consciousness when we were watching this stuff, you know, it really does seem bizarre, but there really is a reason for all of it. You can point to this happened this year, this happened this year, this happened this year, and for some reason now the Banana Splits and H.R. Puff and stuff, you know, happened. And one funny thing, Derek, about the Banana Splits and H.R. Puff and stuff, a little link between them. Sid and Marty Croft, who created Puff and Stuff and all those shows, Puff and Stuff was their first foray into television. They were puppeteers, and they were actually Hanna-Barbera, who did the Banana Splits, hired them to make the Banana Split suits, to design and build them. So they designed and built Bingo, Flegel, Snoopy, and Snork, mm-hmm. Drooper and Snork.
Drooper,
I'm sorry.
And Snork, yeah.
So when Hanna-Barbera's people came and picked up the costumes and walked out with them, and the two brothers, the two Croft brothers, looked at each other and said like $1 million just walked out the door. Like they realized that those costumes were so cool, and they really were, that these guys are going to, you know, whatever, however many hundreds they paid these guys, they're going to take it and make a fortune. And that's why they got into H.R.'s Puff and Stuff, you know.
Yeah, and you know, you point out also another, I guess, defining characteristic, or at least a difference between our generation and the more current generation, is the fact that when we wanted to see these kind of shows, whether it be cartoons or live action like H.R. Puff and Stuff, we had to get up early on Saturday morning in order to get our fix. And then along with that, you mentioned the cereal. And I was thinking, you know, you mentioned Quisp and Quake. You know, as kids, we didn't need LSD for trips. We had Quisp and Quake, which provided its own kind of high.
Yeah, like to this day, I have my Waterloo is Pop-Tarts, you know, because, you know, when they first put them out, it was very unfair because they put Batman comics in the boxes, little Batman comics. I haven't seen one since I was a child, but I'll bet you they were drawn by Joe Giella because it looks like his style. So how could you, every kid loved Batman. So that was almost like the heroin addict giving you a taste, you know, like you got the Pop-Tarts and you got the comic books, but then you have a lifelong habit, you know? So I will never live to be 100 because I've eaten too many Pop-Tarts.
4, 3, 2, 1, Pop-Tarts, new from Kellogg's.
You can eat them on the run, eat them just for fun.
Eat them when you have a party, yeah.
When you want a snack, you can eat them from the pack. Or warm and tasty, good and hearty.
You know, you mentioned comic books, and since this is the Comics Alternative Podcast, let's talk about the art section of Groovy, which is where you spend quite a bit of time discussing a variety of comics. And I think, to your credit, you don't only focus on the underground stuff. I mean, you spend quite a number of pages discussing, you know, Robert Crumb and a variety of others in terms of the underground comics movement. But you also talk about what was going on in mainstream comics as a result of this cultural flowering. I guess starting off with the new Wonder Woman, which I think is quite appropriate.
The Mike Sekulski Wonder Woman, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, I still think the world needs to catch up with that. I mean, that was just such it was just so glorious to me, you know. And it's just, Mike Sekulski, of course, was the founding artist of the Justice League of America, and we have a new Justice League movie coming out any day now.
Yeah.
And so you know, he took Wonder Woman and he turned her, he took away her powers. Now, there had always been reboots of superheroes. The Silver Age was all about, you know, a new Flash, a new Green Lantern, a new Hawkman. That's what really kicked off the so-called Silver Age in the mid-50s. But he did something that was unique at the time. It's more common now, but in 1968, he took away her powers, made her a human, banished her from Paradise Island, put her in groovy clothes, like kind of a Diana Rigg look. Mm-hmm. And apparently Mike Sekulski had a fetish for thigh-high boots, because she always had thigh-high boots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then she existed in a world, she got trained in kung fu by a blind Chinese instructor, which makes you think that kung fu ripped off Mike Sekulski. And I think it was I don't have proof of this, but I think it was the first time the phrase kung fu was in comics. But anyway, so for those issues, I forget how many, I think it was 15 or 20, she was, you know, fighting bad guys, but she was hanging out with, you know, beautiful people, and she's hanging out in psychedelic nightclubs or boutiques. I think she even ran a boutique, or bikers, or you know, hippies. You know, she was it was really cool. And one more thing about Sekulski, Murphy Anderson, who's a great artist. I know all the old guys. I don't know what's going on now, but he called Sekulski a frustrated fashion artist. And if you really look at Sekulski's work, some of those panels, he was quick. He drew stuff quickly, but some of those panels were just, they could have been, you know, fashion sketches. And, I don't want to bore you, Derek, but Kurt Schaffenberger, who drew Lois Lane, said that, you know, one day DC Comics said to him, you better buy some of the current fashion magazines and give Lois, update her look a little. Nobody ever had to tell Sekulski that, you know. Mm-hmm. Sekulski was just, he was there, you know. So his work actually, not just Wonder Woman, but Manhunter Jason's Quest, mm-hmm. In Showcase. It's like a time capsule of the late 60s.
Yeah, and the Maniacs as well. You point that out along with Jason's Quest.
Yeah, the Maniacs was like a little earlier. That was one of my little problems of the puzzle with putting Groovy together, was where do you draw the line? Like, sometimes stuff is like sort of like op art. Like, I don't spend much time at all. I really don't talking about the Batman TV series, mm-hmm. which definitely was groovy, but. Whenever I had to draw the line, it was like, does it lean more towards psychedelic? But yeah, the Maniacs was great. I mean, and Sekulski just, you know, I just love him. I've been reading a lot of his stuff lately, because I've been going back to the JLA, the original Justice League, to do some pieces on that. And I just love the guy. I know he was a speed merchant. I know he was formulaic. I know that you can't get through a Sekulski story without one villain pointing their finger straight up. But the chicks look good, and mm-hmm. He really knows how to lay out a page.
Yeah, and you also spend a little time talking about how some of, you know, the old guard in terms of comics, like Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, tried their hand to greater or lesser degrees of success in trying to engage with this younger, hipper audience. And although you don't spend really much time, except I guess in passing, talking about, let's say, Kirby's Forever People, I mean, you do devote a little more time to Hawk and Dove and how it is very much of its time.
Well, yes. Well, there you go. Because some artists were never going to change. The old guard, and editors also. And there was a revolution going on in comics in the late '60s. So the emergence of Neil Adams and Jim Steranko happened, and they kind of rejected the campiness that happened after the Adam West Batman, and they were being more serious. Of course, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow thing, that was, comics were getting real, but guys like Kirby and Ditko, I think they were always restless. They were always trying new things. A guy like Joe Simon always had to try to keep his finger on this pulse. I mean, just look at, you can't find too many of them, but Sick Magazine, which is one of the Mad Imitators, that was Joe Simon's baby. And so he was really trying to stay current. He was doing a lot of hippie humor in Sick, although it was the kind of finger wagging, like, look at these kids today, but he was still trying, and he wasn't turning a blind eye to it. And I think what happened was that the old guard at the big two, DC and Marvel, were kind of behind the times for a long time before it finally, slapped them in the face, So somewhere around 68, they really started to try. You didn't see any more Irish Snap lettering to my dismay, in the house ads. But the Hawk and Dove, you're absolutely right. That is of its time. I mean, that was like almost ripped from the headlines, because that came out in 1968 when the hot button issue, the 1968 election, hot button issue was the Vietnam War. And so much turbulence, so much was happening. And the question was like, are you a hawk or are you a dove? Are you pro war or are you pro pullout? So, Hawk and the Dove, harnessed that. So that was an amazing moment.
Mm. Well, sticking with the topic of comics, I mean, not only do you cover what was going on in the mainstream, but you spend quite a bit of time discussing the kind of work coming out from, let's say, Robert Crumb, Trina Robbins, Jay Lynch, Kim Deitch, Dennis Kitchen, and you include segments of your various interviews with these guys as well. So, I mean, how does your appreciation and research into the underground comics differ from, maybe in a more substantive way, your appreciation of more mainstream material, if at all, if I'm reading this distinction correctly?
Well, the research is really, kind of life research of, I read the, those late 60s books when they were first coming out as a child. And then sometime during my high school years, I fell out of the comic book habit. But I wasn't reading the undergrounds as they were coming out, but I was lucky enough. My college roommate in college, had a very good collection of the undergrounds, and of course I knew Crumb because you couldn't avoid seeing the Stoned Again poster or the Keep on Trucking, or you kind of knew that about Fritz the Cat, but I didn't really know what a genius he was until I read all of my college roommates' comics, and he Crumb is definitely a genius, and that movement was it was just wild because these guys were absolutely not censoring themselves in any way. They, the way the books were distributed was itself underground. They just went to head shops and they were sold in little iffy bookstores or, urban cafes, like places where, you wouldn't find them in a department store chain, obviously. And, they didn't have any advertising. So it was just coming straight out of somebody's id right onto the page. And Crumb in particular, I mean, he used to draw when he was tripping, so you can tell the stuff that he did back then. And and of course, he is an easy target for criticism because there's a lot of stuff that can perceive that is perceived as racist and sexist, and rightly so, except for I always defend him because I always say he was drawing stuff that was in his head, not necessarily saying this is the character Angel Fu McSpade. He's not saying this is the way I view black women, but he was just drawing stuff that was in his head mm-hmm. from stuff that he was fed all his life, you know, because those kind of racist images are in comics. The ebony character from The Spirit, mm-hmm. is really a terrible stereotype. So and there's a lot of them back there, you know, in subtle ways. So anyway, he was drawing all that stuff. He was getting it out, and I think to this day, I think he's a great artist beyond even his medium. I think he's just like one of the great artists, and he's still amazing. You know, he still looks fantastic. Mm. His work,
yeah, you know,
he doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a moment ago you mentioned something about Neil Adams taking Batman and trying to move him away from the campiness of the 1960s television show. And I wanted to ask you what you thought of as the potential crossroads of groovy culture and camp. I had the pleasure earlier this year of doing an interview with Michael Urey, who came out with that book, Hero a Go-Go from Tomorrow's, about camp culture. What kind of intermingling of camp and groovy do you see, if any? And how was it a challenge not to include more overt campiness in this book, Groovy?
Oh, well, definitely. Definitely there was so much in, like, let's say the Batman series, and that's really where, you know, even the concept of camp really became popularized, because that's what everybody always called Batman, camp, you know. Mm-hmm. It was so colorful. There were rock bands on Batman. You know, Leslie Gore was one of Catwoman's minions, and she sang a song. And Paul Revere and the Raiders actually performed at the Penguins' inauguration as the mayor of Gotham City one time. You know, and then, like I said, the colors. You know, so in putting Groovy together, as I said earlier, that's where I kind of drew the line from. Like, they called Batman op art. You know, that was a term they were using at the time. It's, you know, very archaic term, I think, but I would go with things that lean more towards the psychedelic, but I love the campy stuff, you know. I loved Batman, and it is funny to see it, to see the progression, you know, to see one of the funny things to look for is when you watch old TV shows, when an establishment TV show depicted hippies, it's really hilarious. like Granny one time on the Beverly Hillbillies, she was showing hippies how to dig taters, mm-hmm. and they thought it was a new dance. So they were doing the tater dance, you know, and which is crazy, because it's like an out of touch producer's view of hippies, that they would look at Granny and think, oh, it's a new dance, because by that time, you know, there was that line that, like, once hippies became, you know, came into their own, they weren't looking for dances anymore. They would just, you know, drop acid, go to a Jefferson Airplane show and just dance for 3 hours, just all crazy. Like, they weren't looking for dance crazes. Like, it wasn't American Bandstand, you know. And even on the Dragnet, you know, like, I remember there's an episode with a hippie couple, and they got high on marijuana, and they let their baby drown in the bathtub. And you know, that again was you know, Joe Friday's view, Jack Webb's view of what hippies were, you know. But then, like I said, as time marches on, then more authentic stuff crept in. So by the time you got to the Mod Squad, you know, mm-hmm. The Mod Squad had a hippie sensibility. Pete, Link, and Julie, they had a hippie sensibility, and they went in, and often they posed as hippies to infiltrate a hippie stronghold of maybe drug dealers. They're going after the bad hippies. That show actually did make a distinction between, you know, hippies who were nice people and hippies who were evil people. So, but that's a fun thing to look at, how the establishment through the years viewed groovy culture.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the Beverly Hillbillies episode and the Dragnet one. And along with that, in your book, you also mention an episode of The In-Laws. That was the title of the series, right? And
The Mother's In-Law.
Oh, The Mother's In-Law. That's right.
Sorry, The Mothers-in-Law, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. In-Laws was a film. But The Mothers-in-Law, I vaguely remember that as a kid. And after reading that section of your book, a reference to Mothers-in-Law, I went to YouTube and actually found that scene that you describe when, what is it, the Seeds are playing a group. And I can't remember that the group that they're playing, but they actually play one of their own songs. And you see, you know, the two married couples, this older generation, making faces and derisive comments. And it is quite funny how pop culture, at least for a time, didn't know what to do with hippies
in the youth culture. And what's really, oh yeah, and what's really funny about that scene, Derek, is that the Seeds were playing along. Like, they were actually wearing, like, the clothes that they were wearing and the wigs that they were wearing were not, you know, what you would see them in if you went to see them in a club that night. So they went in there, and then the TV legend Desi Arnaz, you know, probably said, dress them up like hippies, you know, and then they gamely, put on this performance, and they gamely let their song be ridiculed, pushing too hard. And, so that is really funny. It's really meta, you know, that they took part in this, what is really, you know, just a derisive look at their culture.
You're pushing too hard, you're pushing on me. You're pushing too hard on what you want me to be. You're pushing too hard about the things you say. You're pushing too hard every night and day.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me, at one point I remember seeing, I think it was the Lucy Show. It was one of the later sitcoms that Lucille Ball did. And this is when her two kids were old enough. I don't know if they were like high school age or college age. But I remember Lucy's daughter. What is her name? I'm trying to recall now.
Lucy Arnaz.
Lucy Arnaz. Okay, yes. Where she either was in a band or was making reference to the band, and she mentioned some of the songs that they were playing, and she referenced, at least I remember, a couple of titles from Abbey Road, like Mean Mr. Mustard. And I'm even as a youth, knowing Abbey Road, I thought, that's really inappropriate, because I just couldn't see the clean-cut Lucy crew having anything to do with what the Beatles were doing on Abbey Road. And so that's another example of kind of a strange, off-kilter appropriation of this kind of groovy culture into the mainstream television audience, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's great, because having the title "Me, Mr. Mustard" in there meant that the writers took the extra step instead of coming up with, you know, fake titles that just sound like they'd be groovy and are funny. They actually did a little bit of homework, and that struck them as funny. Like, oh, "Mean Mr. Mustard," that sounds stupid. We'll put that one in, you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember an episode where Lucy and she wasn't Ethel anymore. She was Viv.
Yeah.
Vivian Vance actually sing a song in a hippie club dressed as hippies. But what's hilarious? Yeah, they had long wigs and they had headbands and, you know, vests and, you know. But what was funny about it was the song they sang was "Big Girls Don't Cry" by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. So again, that little, you know, and everybody's all the hippies were clapping for him, and that little, you know, thing of like, well, you know, that's not the right song at all to do, you know, but they did it, you know. So that it makes it's really funny. One of my favorite movies is a Bob Hope movie.
Oh, God.
Where he, you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's called How to Commit Marriage, and it's a very groovy movie. It has a wonderful performance by Professor Irwin Khoury as the Maharishi Yogi, a parody of that called the Baba Ziba. And but in one scene, Bob Hope is wearing sideburns, like real mutton chops, and a Nehru jacket and love beads, and he's in a hippie club, and you know, he's saying his usual Bob Hope stuff, like I didn't know if that was a boy or a girl or whatever he's saying, you know. And it's just hilarious and heartwarming, and you know, you just laugh at the stupidity of it.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of some of those old Bob Hope specials where he and George Burns would try to do a skit as hippies. And, oh, God, I mean, even as a kid, I thought there's something really weird and off about that.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, when I was a little child watching Laugh-In, I thought that was authentic grooviness, you know. But then when you look back on it, you realize it was pretty corny and pretty lame, and they were co-opting too. But they did have a young cast of unknowns, mm-hmm. so they were doing, you know, wacky things, and they connected. So there was some authentic stuff on there, but it wasn't quite as authentic as when I was a kid. I was like, oh, this is it. This is psychedelia, you know, but it really wasn't, but it was close.
Yeah. And you spend quite a bit of time writing about Laugh-In and some of the people who were involved in that, in your television section. And I also appreciate the fact that you give some space to the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, because what they were doing was really on the cutting edge. I mean, so much on the edge that it got them canceled.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's like one of the main things. Like I said, when I started Groovy, I thought it was going to be mostly a lighthearted romp, and it is very lighthearted. But the dark stuff that happened in the decade, you can't separate them, you know. Mm-hmm. So the struggle for civil rights, the Vietnam War, the assassinations, you know, all those terrible events, mm-hmm. are inextricably linked with groovy culture. Now, the Smothers Brothers, of course, that almost became a political show. It was really weird because these guys were like very unassuming looking, you know, like kind of nerdy looking guys, but they were friends with Bobby Kennedy, and they brought on all these acts, you know, I don't have the list in front of me, but acts such as like the Doors or the Jefferson Airplane. I know they had a film with the Beatles on, mm-hmm. and Cass Elliot. Like, they would just have these, like, you know, authentically groovy acts on, and then they would be doing a lot of anti-war humor. And Tommy Smothers believes that once Nixon was inaugurated, that's when and why they got canceled.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the musical acts that the Smothers Brothers had on. You know, it was interesting that, you know, the Beatles made their debut in America, arguably, on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then when they quit touring, they actually sent their, what we would call today, music videos to Ed Sullivan to air. So they were still on Ed Sullivan. But because of the politics of the time, Ed Sullivan being more conservative, old guard, and, you know, Dick and Tommy Smothers being more hip to what was going on at the time, the Beatles made the decision to, instead of sending their videos to Ed Sullivan, letting them debut for American audiences on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And I think that the videos that you were referring to, Revolution and Hey Jude in 68.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, seeing Hey Jude. I mean, that was just wild, you know. And Derek, you told me something I didn't know. I had no idea that they gave first dibs to the Smothers Brothers. But yeah, that was what the Beatles decided to do, mm-hmm. because they were so sick of the road. They were sick of playing to this screaming din. And so they just decided, okay, from now on, we're going to be studio hermits, and we're going to make videos. And a lot of, they called them films. Yeah. And a lot of really cool stuff emerged from that. You know, I think there's a film they did for Penny Lane, which is like really, really neat, you know, mm-hmm. like, so, and yeah, the Hey Jude one is really cool. And I remember seeing that when it first aired, or it felt like it was when it first aired, but, that's what they were doing, you know. Meanwhile, the groups that were coming up were actually going on the shows and performing. And of course they didn't want to lip sync. I remember the Byrds went on some show early on and refused to lip sync, but they said they cut their own throats because the studios weren't really equipped at that time to get a good mix. So if they had lip synced, if that's the past tense of lip sync, it would have sounded better, you know. Well, you're an educator, you have to correct me, but it would have sounded better because. You know, it would have been the real mix going through the board as they know it, but they didn't have that down yet. Ed Sullivan, of course, insisted that everybody perform live.
Yeah. You know, I do want to say a couple things about your other book that came out in 2015, and that is Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America between 1957 and 1972. So in what ways does your book that comes out tomorrow, Groovy, how is it like maybe a logical transition from what you did a couple of years ago with Monster Mash?
I know, that's really funny because, Derek, I work in secrecy. Like, I'm just so private that, it took me 14 months to do all the interior pages to finish them, and I didn't tell a soul. And, but if somebody asked me what I was working on, I'd say it's definitely a follow-up to Monster Mash, but it's not about monsters. And I do think that they're like the same book. I mean, this new book, Groovy, is like Monster Mash, but it's about, it's lava lamps and love beads instead of Frankenstein and, mm-hmm. and Dracula, you know. But it's the same approach. It's a very, visual approach for both books, and the same approach, like, themes and trying to keep the chronology going, and interviews with whoever I could get on those topics. And there's even a little crossover between Groovy culture and monster culture now and then, both of them were, labors of love. They're both really fun to work on. And, I hope people find Groovy like they found Monster Mash.
Yeah, because, to some degree, these two movements are concurrent, right? Because you take Monster Mash up through the early 70s, which is around the time that things are petering out with Groovy culture.
Yeah, I didn't want to put hard and fast years in the titles for Groovy. It seemed like you'd know it, but and plus that was so fluid, the psychedelic thing was so fluid. Like, there were, the Zombies put out a song in 1964, less than 6 months after the Beatles landed at JFK, and it's called She's Not There. And that song, it's amazing that it came out in 64, because it sounds like it came out in 68, mm-hmm. I think it's because they were just so talented musically. Rod Argent was, one of the greatest organists in pop. Whereas the monster craze, you could definitely point to the beginning. You could definitely say, boom, the Big Bang was 1957 when they first showed all those horror films, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Mummy, on television for the first time. And then they got crazy ratings, and then they started bringing out monster models and novelty songs and the Monsters in the Addams Family. So the Big Bang is really easy to point to with the monsters. But with Groovy culture, it was little wisps of things that happened here and there. But by the time you get to 1967, it's on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do like how in Groovy, you do give quite a number of nods to the precursors of what eventually flowered again in terms of Groovy culture, going back to early 20th century art movements, especially.
Yeah, well, because I think that, the Kaleidoscope in particular, it's really hard to believe that thing came out in the 19th century, because that looks like, the liquid projection that they had in San Francisco at Jefferson Airplane shows. It looks like a psychedelic experience when you're looking at a kaleidoscope, but that thing's been around. There were always all these like little tremors, little precursors. And then once modernism, started happening in art, nobody was trying to, paint from reality anymore necessarily. They were trying to be evocative, and they're trying to be avant-garde, and they were, experimenting with color, and that has a lot to do with what happened later, And I one time Robert Crumb said, after he went on his first acid trip, that's when he stopped drawing from life, because he used to had a sketchbook, always done. And he would, draw from life. He would draw his wife, or he'd draw whatever he saw. And then once he did acid, that he stopped drawing from life. He wasn't looking at an object and drawing it anymore. He was picturing it in his mind's eye.
Hmm. Well, can you tell us anything about what you may be working on now, or what your next book project might be?
Well,
or is this part of the secretive thing?
Yeah, it's a secretive thing. I need a publisher. I don't. My next idea, I have to find somebody to put it out. But yeah, but you know what? One thing I'll say, Derek, it can go on your shelf right after right between Monster Mash and Groovy, or right after Groovy. It'll in my vision, I'm going to do a third book just like that. You know, fingers crossed that I can get somebody to roll the dice on this one. It's not as sexy, but it's going to be great. Listen to me.
Well, okay. My curiosity has definitely piqued, and I'm wanting to know what this is going to be about. But your new book, Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture, comes out tomorrow from Tomorrow's Publishing. And it includes not only a lot of information on comics from, let's say, the late 60s into the early 70s, but also television, film, art in a larger sense. And so there's a lot really packed in here. And I think all of our listeners will find this, both the comics parts and the non-comic sections, great entertainment and very informative. Also, your book from 2 years ago, Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America, that's also from Tomorrow's, and I strongly recommend that our listeners get that one as well. Mark? Thank you very much for taking the time and talking with me on the Comics Alternative.
Derek, the check is in the mail.
Okay. Groovy, man. Groovy.
Thank you, sir. Groovy right back at you.
So there you have it, my interview with Mark Voger about his new book, Groovy, When Flower Power Bloomed in Pop Culture. I really enjoyed that conversation and discussing the new book, not only because Groovy is well written and includes a lot of information, but it was a trip down memory lane for me, as I hope it was for Mark and many of you listeners. And if you want to find a copy of Groovy, then head on over to comicsalternative.com/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and you will be transported to Amazon.com, where you can search for Groovy, and you'll find that you can get it for 36% off of the cover price. And while you're at it, check out Mark's other book, Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America from 1957 to 1972. You can find that on Amazon for 33% off. And if you do click through to Amazon from the Comics Alternative site, not only will you be helping out Mark Voger by getting his books, but you'll also be helping out the Comics Alternative as well. But you can also find great deals at the website of our sponsor for this episode, and that is Discount Comic Book Service. Remember, go to dcbservice.com. They will take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs and at unbeatable prices. And after you do get your comics there, get in touch with me and let me know what you thought about my conversation with Mark Voger. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message online via SpeakPipe. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way by picking up the phone and dialing 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427. You can also email us. We're twoguys@comicsalternative.com, or you can email me directly. I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com. And you can find us all over the social media sphere, such as on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, YouTube, and Slack. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can also find us on TuneIn, on Spotify, on iHeartRadio, and on Google Play Music. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, comicsalternative.com. We've got more interviews lined up in the days to come, so be sure to listen up for those. Until then, I'm Derek. Take care.